And the court will proceed to the sixth case, Carracker v. Raker v. Rent-A-Center.
May it please the court, counsel. The issue before this court is whether the relief Stephen Carracker and the class that he represented was de minimis. If this court holds that that relief is de minimis, it will be affirming Judge McCuskey's holding that the plaintiffs and the class were not entitled to attorney fees and costs. At the outset, I'd like to correct a typographical error. It is in the table of contents of the short appendix. It shows at A37, it lists the order of May 19th, 2005, which is the order denying fees and costs. The date should be May 19th, 2006. And I think that that may be significant because if you read the table of contents, it appears that the order on attorney fees was issued before the court had the declarations from Rent-A-Center indicating that they had followed the court's injunction. In other words, on February 3rd, 2006, Rent-A-Center filed with the district court certain declarations that all the stores in Illinois had been searched for the test results, that the district manager's offices had been searched, corporate headquarters had been searched, storage had been searched, and the database had been searched. The declarations then went on to point out that all of that information had been gathered and the test results had been destroyed. The reason that I think that's important is because in the opinion denying attorney fees, the district court referred to these test results being under lock and key at corporate headquarters. And yet it had before it these declarations which indicated that 108 test results had been found with stores and offices within the state of Illinois. So I don't know how the court concluded that all the test results were somehow in corporate headquarters under some type of lock and key. The court did mention a sentence of this court's opinion in the first appeal decision, but that it relied on an opinion of the district court initially. So what I'm saying is that at the very time the court denied us fees and costs, it had in front of it the declarations that Rent-A-Center had indeed gathered and destroyed all these results. And those declarations indicated the results were not all at corporate headquarters under lock and key. I think that that's important because I thought all along, and as we outlined in our initial brief, that there was no dispute that these test results were in various places and not kept confidential, particularly in the stores. This is not a case that involves one particular plaintiff who had one particular event during his or her employment. The relief in this case is not limited to Stephen Carracker.
But now that I have the right lawyer in front of me, let me put this question to you. As I read the record, there weren't any members of the plaintiff's class still employed at RAC at the time the district court awarded injunctive relief, right?
That is correct.
And is there any evidence that any of the plaintiffs were still working at RAC that had taken and failed the APP management test?
That any were?
Yeah, there were none of them that were employed, so there's no way you can tie anybody who was currently there to the test.
Well, I think the fact that there were 100, when we went through the evidence in the first appeal, the personnel files, when an employee left, went to corporate headquarters. The fact that there were 108 test results in stores and district manager offices in Illinois would indicate that there were 108 still employed, 108 members of the class. Your Honor, what I read is that people are changing employment frequently. The implications that you would have to still be an employee would significantly limit enforcement of the civil rights statutes. The other thing is that the Carrickers test results were still at Rent-A-Center. We're concerned about is the possibility of those test results being used. And I don't say that lightly, subject to subpoena, subject to referrals to other people, that type of thing. The test results are now destroyed. Not only did Judge McCuskey order the gathering and the destruction of the test results, he also ordered that those test results could not be considered by Rent-A-Center in making any future employment decisions. But I'd like to touch on something else. As I said before, this isn't an individual plaintiff with one employment decision at stake. Somehow I think we've lost sight of the fact that the decision of this court in the first appeal served a significant public purpose in that it, for the first time, this court recognized that the MMPI was a medical test. And that just didn't have significance for Mr. Carriker or the members of the class. It had significance in the public domain, significant impact. And at the district court and also before this court, we listed all the attention this court's decision got by human resource organizations, by bar association, the internal kind of reporting of this court's decision. I'm used to the court's decisions being reported in, you know, law reviews, in the statutes, reference footnotes to the statutes of a decision. But this got picked up by personnel and human resource people throughout this circuit. And we cited all the sites. We just did a very quick computer check. And we cited, listed those cases, those citations in the appendix, so that those the thrust of those articles and those publications was to have employers in this circuit relook at the type of tests they were giving their employees or their prospective employees. Provided the very
direct benefit to the Carrickers. What would you say that is? That their records are destroyed?
Yes.
That's the extent of the direct benefit? I mean, I appreciate the impact the case may have in broader context, but we have to look at the direct benefit to the plaintiffs, do we not, on the attorney's fees question?
Yes, but also the class members.
But we don't have any class members. Do we get directly benefited, as Judge Williams was saying? At the time of the injunctive...
Well, at the time of the injunctive relief, I believe that there were 108 members of the class still working there because their records were in the stores in Illinois. Mr. Carriker received $5,000, which was not opposed. No, so to me, if you go back and you look at whether or not the employer was forced to do something and ordinarily would not have had to do, that changed the relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant. And I think the implications are very significant in this case because not only the significance of the decision, but the effect upon the public as a whole, and that can't be lost. Because if an employee leaves an employer in the middle of litigation, do we drop it? Do we lose the significance of that issue?
And what's your best case on the fact that it serves a public purpose and therefore we should award fees?
The significance of the decision itself and the way it has been picked up and publicized with employers, I think, throughout the country.
And I understand that. I understand you're giving us the impact of the decision. I wondered if you had any authority to say that fees are warranted when an opinion has such an impact in whatever.
Well, I thought Justice O'Connor.
Yeah, I was asking what's your best case to support that argument that you're making here, that we should consider that the impact of the ruling in all the corporations and HR departments that you cited, that's, that that would justify fees even if you didn't have an individual plaintiff?
We cited Justice O'Connor's three-part test in Farrer versus Hobby. We cited that at page 10 of our brief. And particularly on page 11, she concluded her opinion by outlining three factors: the extent of the relief, the significance of the legal issue on which the plaintiff prevailed, and the public purpose served. So. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
Please, Court. Your Honors, the single issue in this appeal, and I think plaintiffs concede this in their brief, is whether the district court abused its discretion in holding that the plaintiffs were not prevailing parties in for purposes of recovery of their attorney's fees under the ADA. Plaintiffs didn't even address the issue of prevailing party status in the district court, and so none of the arguments in their brief, none of what you heard today in that regard, was in front of the district court when they made their decision.
Were you the prevailing party?
Was Rent-A-Center the prevailing party? I don't know that under the definition for purposes of the ADA that there was a prevailing party.
Yeah, that's going to be my next question.
Right.
So this is a suit, as you view it, without a prevailing party.
Based on the Supreme Court's definition and their interpretation of Section 1988, yes, Your Honor. The correct standard, as Your Honors I think have already pointed out, is the one that was enunciated by the Texas Supreme Court in by the U.S. Supreme Court in Texas State Teachers, and later in Hewitt, and later in Rhodes, which is that the plaintiff must receive an actual relief on the merits that results in a direct benefit to the plaintiff. And the court went on to specify that a mere technical victory is insufficient to confer prevailing party status. That was the basis for the district court's holding regarding attorney's fees. Plaintiffs may have received a favorable judgment, and that judgment may have been accompanied by an injunction. But there's simply no direct benefit to either the plaintiffs or to the class as a result of that injunction.
As a result of this lawsuit, though, isn't Rent-A-Center presently, sometime during the course of this lawsuit, changed directions and stopped administering this test?
Actually, Your Honor, it was a year and a half before the lawsuit was filed. In July of 2000, Rent-A-Center changed its policies, stopped administering the APT test, and stopped holding failing test results against employees.
But is counsel correct that about 100 and, I don't know what the number was, but that there were test results floating around in individual Rent-A-Center stores for employees that had taken that test that were not destroyed at the time, even as far as the time that the injunction was entered?
We found 108 copies of test results in managers' files and in storage cabinets in market manager offices, and that's correct. There's no evidence in the record that any of these individuals were still employed at Rent-A-Center at the time that the judgment was entered in this case.
When you opposed the injunction, did you make it clear to the, I assume you opposed?
The injunction? Actually, once this court's ruling came down that the APT test itself violated the ADA, counsel actually worked sort of together to formulate the relief that would naturally flow from that. In other words, don't give the test, don't hold failing test results against employees. It seemed like a logical. There was no briefing on what the injunction should be. In other words,
well, I'm a little lost on this. But if the representation is the test is not being used to the court, what was the purpose of the injunction?
It's a good question. Like I said, the plaintiffs proposed the relief.
You agreed to destroy the records, right?
Correct.
You agreed you're not going to use them.
Correct.
But then you agreed to an injunction, but in some in futuro, to make sure you would never return to the old policy. Is that was the position you took?
I guess, and that's part of the reason that we didn't have much problem with the injunction as it was phrased, is because we weren't doing any of that anyway, and we were happy to destroy the test results because by that point, we weren't using them regardless. And that's sort of the crux of my argument. By the time that the lawsuit was filed, forget about by the time the judgment was rendered, by the time the lawsuit was filed, it had been a year and a half since we'd even given an APT test. It had been a year and a half since we had required a passing score on the APT test for promotion. The fact that there were random APT test results still remaining in our home office and in market managers' offices was a result of having tens of thousands of employees and files that don't get sent to corporate headquarters when they should.
But during the lawsuit, though, you argued vigorously that this was not a test that was covered by the ADA.
Correct.
And that could freely be administered.
Correct.
And they took the opposite position and eventually prevailed on that. So I'm just a hard time wondering why that they're not viewed as a prevailing party, given what has occurred here.
Well, because the touchstone of the prevailing party inquiry is whether there was a direct benefit to the plaintiff or plaintiffs. And under these particular circumstances, because we didn't give the test anymore, because we didn't require the test for promotion anymore, the injunction essentially just ordered us to stop doing something that we weren't doing anyway and hadn't done for several years.
Could have resumed doing at any time.
Also,
if the case would have come out the other way, you could have continued to do the test and be doing it right now.
I suppose we could have. This is not an instance, however, in which we stopped giving the test or stopped relying on the test in the midst of litigation because we were concerned about what the judgment would be. This is an instance in which, like I said, in July of 2000, a year and a half before they even filed this lawsuit, we stopped giving the test for our own reasons because, well, I don't know what the reasons were. I weren't involved in the decision. But the fact is the decision was made a year and a half prior to this lawsuit even being filed.
So let me just get these numbers right. The records were in more than 100 employees or former employees' files at the time the lawsuit was filed.
Apparently.
Right? And then at the time the injunction was entered, that material was still in their files, but they were not employees.
Well, we don't know whether they're employees or not. There's no evidence in the record that any of the members of the class were still employed at the time.
Okay. And would anyone else have had access to those documents, outside the company? Could those have been obtained, say, by a prospective employer or something? I'm just trying to get at what use they're sitting there in the file. How could they be used against one of the class members?
Well, and I'm sort of at a loss for that, too, Your Honor. I mean, certainly Rent-A-Center has a strong policy against disclosing employee information of any kind. Obviously, Social Security numbers, medical records, typical employer policy of giving just the most basic of information to new employers when they're calling about for a reference. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that any of these test results were ever improperly disclosed to anyone, future employers or anyone else for that matter. No evidence in the record of any threat of any sort of improper disclosure. And I think the Texas State Teachers case is instructive on that point. In that case, the Supreme Court held that a school policy was unconstitutional, but they went on to say that if that was the only relief that the plaintiff had gotten, there would be no prevailing party because there was no evidence that unconstitutional policy had ever actually been applied to prohibit the plaintiffs in that case from doing anything. And I think the same reasoning applies here. Maybe we shouldn't have given the test in the first place. There may have been some test results left in some files that because it's a big administrative task to purge that type of stuff. But there's no evidence that of any sort of threat that those test results would ever be disclosed to anybody. Quite frankly, it's more likely that more people saw the test results in taking them out of the files to destroy them than anybody saw them in the previous 5 years. So there's no benefit whatsoever as a result of the purely ministerial act of taking those tests out of the files for the purpose of destroying them. But I want to highlight one thing, and that is that none of these arguments were made to the district court. The briefing in their petition for attorney's fees and their memorandum of law and their evidence, none of it related to prevailing party status, none of it related to how we destroyed the tests or who was employed or who wasn't employed. They simply didn't make a prevailing party argument in the district court. And it was not part of what the district court considered in making its ruling on the attorney's fees issue. And so we think that the district court correctly held that neither the plaintiffs, neither the named plaintiffs nor the class received any actual benefit whatsoever as a result of the injunction in this case. We think the district court correctly held that on that basis they were not prevailing parties. We ask that that ruling be affirmed.
I have just two questions at this point. One, I'd like you to respond to Mr. Johnson's latest point that this wasn't discussed before Judge McKinney and McCuskey, excuse me, wrong state. And secondly, under our case law, the decision of directly benefits is a factual determination made by a district judge, and we review for clear error. So I guess I'd like you to address that also. What specifically is the clear error that the judge made below in his factual determination here?
I think we would take the position that the clear error was the application of the law to the facts, that we thought it was an extremely significant decision which had a profound effect on hundreds of people.
So that element of the FAR, the Hobby decision, was not adequately applied by Judge McCuskey to these facts.
That's right. And, Your Honor, we went into great detail in the petition for attorney fees about the impact that this had throughout the labor management specter, the human resources personnel, whatever.
Now, is that...
But I don't want to...
How does that affect the direct benefits aspect? I appreciate that element. May well be satisfied by the impact of the case. But on the direct benefit aspect, where do we find the error by the judge?
Well, I believe counsel's wrong on this when he said they stopped the test in 2000. And we cited at page 18 of our brief the memo that Rent-A-Center issued in August of 2000 about eligibility for promotion. And you either had to have passed the APT test or gotten a certain score on another test. So they were still using the APT test results if you had not taken the other test. So to say that they weren't being taken into consideration simply is not true, according to the own memo that they issued. But I don't want to belittle the effect of the destruction of these test results. We talked about, in the first appeal, the kinds of things that were contained in the narratives, the kind of scoring on the 9 scales. Those could be extraordinarily damaging. And the Rent-A-Center never took the position that there was no need for an injunction. I mean, they had no time during this litigation had they moved to gather these test results and destroy them. And in our initial brief in the first appeal, we talked at length about how the results were not kept in a confidential manner in the stores, how the store manager would discuss one individual's test results in front of other employees. As to not saying we were a prevailing party, I thought with the decision of this court that it was clear we had prevailed. So thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.